dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver.
You're listening to episode 562 of Unwelcome Guests. Our biggest enemy is ourselves. I'm Robin Upton, and we're going to start the show with some quotes from award-winning teacher, 30 years experience, and an expert in the history of schools. This is John Taylor Gatto.
The very first commissioner of American schooling, national commissioner of schooling, a fellow named William Torrey Harris, wrote in 1906 that the point of institutional schooling was to turn people against themselves. So he was really quite advanced. The idea of dividing and conquer usually means several parties involved, but to be divided against yourself, self-alienation, is the expression he used. That was the point of it. He said, this purpose is best achieved in dark, airless corridors. In other words, in dismal places. And anyone who's passed through the usual public schooling place knows what he's talking about. Now, he was very open about this whole enterprise being to the advantage of management. You know what interests me, and it really intrigues me, is a lot of perfectly respectable people read these things, and I don't know what they're thinking, that the person issuing such a statement as self-alienation being the purpose of schooling, and him being the top dog in the school institute, that what is he, joking? What is the point of saying that? What is the point of Horace Mann saying we must find a way to break the bonds of association among working men? Do you actually think they didn't mean that? Then why say it? These clues to what the enterprise actually is are everywhere. You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist. For the most part, until very recently, the people doing this were fairly open about what they were up to. Our biggest enemy is ourselves. We have a population, and including all the intelligent people, who have been conditioned to actually read this stuff, to see it, and to ignore it as if it didn't happen at all. I mean, all this stuff is, again, I don't want to suggest a cabal, but this is quietly overlooked by the newspapers, the popular journals, television. This is something that gentlemen would rather not talk about. It lies at the heart of the capitalist logic. We are so untrained to think, I'm talking about very intelligent people, that we simply swallow hook, line, and sinker, as the Rush Limbaughs and the Glenn Becks of the world do, whatever our betters tell us. You know, if I hear the term free market again, I don't think a free market has existed in the United States since I was born in 1935. The market's rigged by enormous subsidies that go to favored businesses. It's rigged in a half dozen other ways, but that way alone would tip the scales. You're embedded in a house of mirrors. Nothing is what it seems to be. If our productive population couldn't be reduced to a consuming population, the rise of the corporations could not have taken place. The corporation must, for its health, have a clientele who are radically incomplete. Because it's just part of this hall of illusion, hall of mirrors, I call it, that our society's become. It's truly disgusting. And it doesn't make the slightest difference whether Republicans have control of Congress or Democrats. They're the same people. Look at their campaign contributions.
That was a compilation of separate John Taylor Gatto clips. Now, my wife, when she heard I was doing another John Taylor Gatto episode, she said, oh, you've done enough on school. I'm sure people understand about school. I mean, I wish it was true, but I still get a lot of email from people saying, if there's a conspiracy about schools, it seems to be that that's just because it's so personal, because many of us have spent years incarcerated in them. That's just such a sore point, the thought that perhaps schools might not be set up for people's benefit, maybe set up for the benefit of the people who set them up. I mean, I'm flippant about it, but it does seem that is a major one to crack. Well, maybe people think, well, yes, okay, I'm now out of school, so that's done. Neglecting the fact that a lot of people do a lot of things they otherwise wouldn't, because they feel they need to do the best for their kids. That means they need to give them a good education, overlooking the fact that it's actually an indoctrination. It's not about bringing the best out of the children, it's about squeezing the children's imaginations into the set of available choices. Perhaps it just affects me more because I'm a school teacher. Now let me try the following exercise on you. What are the prime factors of 21? Now, you might be in a group who says, "Whoa, math, I don't do math." Or you might say, "Yeah, I can figure that out." But it doesn't matter. Did you ever ask yourself, why would somebody want to know prime factors? It's not a question which you're allowed to ask in school. Now, I've been subject to the strongest disciplinary action of my teaching career for encouraging children to ask that question, which I think is not an unreasonable question. I met somebody the other day, 20-something years my senior, and asked her about prime factors, and she said, yeah, she could do prime factors. I said, have you ever needed to? And she said, no, I don't think so. But somebody somewhere has decided, yes, let's teach kids prime factors. Now, I just googled on applications of prime factors, and I got less than 10 hits. I didn't follow them up. They're probably applications involving a maths exam. I'm not saying maths is unimportant. I've studied maths for many years, and it seems to me plus, times, minus, and divide, yeah, percent, perhaps, these are important things. Make the area of a rectangle, yeah, that's important. So there is something there, but an awful lot less than the amount of time which people are told they have to spend on maths. So why make that decision? It seems to me maths is one of the most abstract and left brain tasks, one of the most disengaging from the real world, at least the way that it's taught in most schools. And yes, it is about alienation, I would say. Now, why is maths a high status subject in the way that dance or singing is a low status subject? No, it's not only about possible salaries you might get. It's more complex than that. I think it comes back to alienation. If somebody is demonstrated high facility with mathematics, that's somebody who's capable of abstracting themselves from the real world, that's somebody who might fit well into a machine-oriented hierarchy. Am I saying, well, we shouldn't do any maths unless we have a use for it? No. Maths can be a beautiful thing. Some of the reason I spent so long on maths was that I found some beauty in it. I don't think beauty is something you can command people to search for. If it strikes you that way, then great. But why do we force children to go through it for so long? Answer, I think, to persuade most of them that they are unworthy. Now, look at languages. We mentioned before there's a linguistic hierarchy with certain languages at the top. Well, in my experience as a foreign language teacher and a foreign language learner, it comes down to interest. Everybody has some facility to learn languages, and the more interested you are, the more you'll learn. And the languages which I have learnt the best have basically been outside of a formal hierarchical scholastic setting, and which have been inspired by personal relationships, personal commitment, everything which flourishes in real life, but which withers and dies in a school. Now, to get back to the issue of prime factors, what are the prime factors of 11,473,412? Well, yeah, good luck with that one. If you've got a 15-digit number and you're going to get prime factors, you're not going to get very far with the method that you were taught in school. So what would you do if you really needed to know, for whatever peculiar reason we could dig up? Answer, you go to Google, you'd say prime factorizer, and I've done it. And yeah, you type in the number, press go, and there's a list of all your prime factors. So we've got a method for doing something which you never really want done in real life, and we're still teaching it to kids. And there's a much better method, which doesn't involve any time and effort, and doesn't make mistakes. And the method that we're teaching only works in exams with little examples. So the message here is that there are new ways of doing things. Now, if there's one thing we can be clear about, amidst all the chaos and dire predictions for what might happen in the world, it is that things will not be working for very long in the way that they used to work. So we're in desperate need of new ideas, people who don't wait for teacher to tell them what to do, but just get on and do it, because it needs trying. People who are unschooled. Now let's hear an interview from earlier this March by Gnostic Media.
Why don't you start out by telling us, who is John Taylor Gatto?
Okay, I was born in Western Pennsylvania, in a small coal mining steelworking town about 40 miles from Pittsburgh. The name is Monongahela, and it was quite an interesting place to grow up during World War II. The sky was always red or black, red with flames at night and black with soot in the day. The people were genuinely a melting pot community. The population was 4,400, and there were 48 different religious denominations in town, which I only as an old fellow have come to see made a lot of nervous times for ministers, etc. Anyway, the town taught me independence, self-reliance, critical thinking, so many things just came from being in a genuine community where people looked out for one another in a kind of a tough-minded way. When I came to New York City and it had the reputation of being a melting pot, and I quickly saw that everyone in the city was ghettoized pretty strictly, and the schools ghettoized them further, I was a little bit taken aback, and after a while I became very angry about it, because I had grown through my teen years in a real community. I don't know how many of those are left in the United States. So I went to two Ivy League colleges, first Cornell and then Columbia. And as I told an audience at Geneva College in Western Pennsylvania a few days ago, I cannot remember a single thing I learned very expensively at those two colleges. And when I came out of college, I went into the advertising business as a copywriter, but it seemed to be Well, dull is the right word. I said, I can't believe, now I'm 22 or whatever. I said, I can't believe people do this all their life. And they sit around arguing about adjectives or adverbs. So my roommate was, a chef who opened a restaurant. He also had a teaching degree without a photo ID on it. And he threw it into the drawer after teaching one day, and he said, you'd have to be a lunatic to make your money that way. Then he went to the Virgin Islands and opened a swell restaurant called the Club Comanche. And when I was in between advertising jobs, it occurred to me that I could take his license and substitute teach, which I did, and that changed my life, because the first or second assignment I got up in Harlem was teaching Spanish classes, and I probably have 90 words of Spanish, but I can tell time. So I asked the classes as they come in whether they knew how to tell time. None did, and I was able to fill 40 minutes, although I had to stretch things. Then it takes about 15, teaching them how to tell time. The third class I met that day brought with it the principal, a white lady with a face that had turned dark purple. She was so angry. She took me out in the hall and asked what I was doing. I said, I'm teaching them how to tell time. She said, that is the entire curriculum for the month of June. How will I explain this to the regular teacher when she came back? And I didn't think I heard correctly. I said, no, it takes 15 minutes to tell time. It can't be the whole curriculum for the month of June. Her last words to me were, you will never be hired at this school again, which sort of upset me a little, but since there were hundreds and hundreds of schools, then they all needed substitutes. It didn't put me off my feed. And the next school I went to, I was given remedial reading for, I think, 9-year-olds. And before the class started, a little girl named Milagros came up to me and said, I don't belong in this class. I can read anything. And I said, now, dear. I said, this is all done scientifically, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Milagros grabs a huge book from the teacher's desk, a readings, and she said, open it anywhere and I'll show you. So I opened it at random to The Devil and Daniel Webster, a 19th century story written in 200 word long sentences with a really obscure vocabulary. And she did. She read it flawlessly. So I said, well, we make mistakes too, Milagros. I'll speak to the principal at lunch hour and we'll get you moved. But when I spoke to the principal at lunch hour, her face turned that deep shade of purple, and she said, I am not used to taking advice from substitute teachers, and furthermore, Mr. Gatto, you are extremely innocent. These children will memorize a story to make it appear that they can read. So, good God. Of course, I opened the book at random, so she would have had to memorize the entire reader. But nevertheless, even memorizing The Devil and Daniel Webster was far beyond anything I personally could have done. So anyway, the lady said she'd come in after school and show me. And then she said, and you will never be hired in this school again. So she comes in after school. Milagros can read anything, held upside down. The woman gets angrier and angrier instead of delighted and repeats, you will never be. She said, Milagros, you will be moved on Monday. You can go now. And then when Lagos was gone, she said, you will never be hired again. Well, that was the beginning of 30 years in the classroom. I said to my wife, I'm just going to teach long enough to see how far I can push these kids who are supposed to be terminally stupid, you know. And the truth is, after 30 years, I never reached the bottom of that well. So, when the New York State Teacher of the Year competition came along, somebody put my name up because I had evolved a kind of classroom program that didn't take place in the classroom. I used all New York City as a text. I pitched the lessons for 13-year-olds on exactly the level that I had learned at Cornell and Columbia, and my kids began winning enormous strings of prizes reserved for students in special high schools, etc. So the first time my name went up, I was named first runner-up state teacher of the year, but I was also named New York City teacher of the year. And the second time my name went up, I was named New York State teacher of the year. Well, the phone rang, and I began to get invitations around the country, and people flew in to look at my class, which didn't make me very happy because I had to hide what I was actually doing. So finally, I resigned on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal, saying I wasn't prepared to hurt children anymore. And the phone rang, and it was the vice president, not the president, but I did go to the White House, and I spoke before the vice president, then in the old Senate office building.
Which vice president was that?
That was the guy who couldn't spell potato. Nice fellow.
Dan, good old Dan Quayle.
It was Dan Quayle. And then I spoke before the New American Schools Committee in the old Senate office building, came back to New York, and got a call from NASA Goddard Space Center. This is really bringing a certain smile to my lips. I said, are you sure you have the right number? I spent my life talking to 13-year-olds. Well, they wanted me to come back to Washington, to Beltsville, and speak before the engineering colloquium. So when I was absolutely certain they wanted me to come down, I went down, spoke to the engineering colloquium, got back to New York City, and there was an invitation from, let me see, it was from the Colorado Librarians Association. There was also one from the Fluid Controls Institute of Philadelphia. By this time, I was having a good old time. My wife and I had decided we have a 125-acre farm in upstate New York, and we were going to be garlic farmers. But I said, you know, these will peter out when the Wall Street Journal article does, and that was 30 years ago. Or no, it was 20 years ago, and last year I was the keynote speaker for the South Korean National Education Convention in 10 Australian cities for the first national homeschooling convention in Australia. I consulted with the Colombian government in Bogota and almost got kidnapped. And I spoke in Budapest, Hungary, Amsterdam, Holland, and twice in London, so, as well as in all the American states. So you can see that at 75, I don't have all that much time left to be a garlic farmer, but I still hope.
Well, that's great. How did you almost get kidnapped in Colombia?
Well, I went there with some big shot from the Cato Institute. Went down there, and they put us up at the International Hotel, which is a really fine place down there, and surrounded by mountains. I mean, Colombia is a lovely country. My Cato Institute companion decided to go out and walk around town, and I remember saying to Marshall, there has to be a reason why the guards in front of the hotel are carrying submachine guns. That's very impressive, I must tell you.
That must have been back during the revolution days.
As I understand it, I would hardly represent myself as an expert on Colombia, but it's a kind of cash occupation to kidnap people. So,
yeah, well, I know it used to be a lot worse back in the 80s and 90s, but I think it's pretty mellow and considered a favorite.
Well, that would be good, because it's a country well worth going to. Anyway, my Cato partner strayed a few blocks away from the hotel, and I went to find him. He said he was just going to look at the market down the street. So when I got there, he was clearly being surrounded. It wasn't right up against his body, but you could see that a cordon had been made around poor Marshall. And fortunately, somebody from the hotel, probably because this fellow was well known, came with a guard after us. And when he pulled us both away and got us back to the hotel, he said, they were going to kidnap you. So I got a good laugh out of that, too, because I'm not worth a sou.
Yeah, you know, Colombia today is actually a favorite tourist destination, but there was a while there that it was pretty bad down there.
Well, it deserves to be. The people are wonderful. The food is excellent, and the country itself is quite lovely.
Yeah, I've been down to South America. I haven't been into Peru or into Colombia specifically, but I've spent some time down there. Would you like to talk about the old schoolhouses?
Sure. What developed American power, inventiveness, and wealth was a kind of crazy quilt of schooling offerings, but I'll go to the more formal ones in one- and two-room schoolhouses, which would contain between 40 and 90 kids, since it was impossible, especially in the independent air of colonial America and early federal America, to actually teach 90 kids. They were broken up into groups, and those groups were half taught by accomplished students, not A students, but students accomplished in leadership and with a pretty good understanding of what the business to be learned was. Because of this heavy student participation, and I would say also the shortness of the term of confinement, it hardly ever went beyond 2.5 months, and the average amount of time per day was 2 hours. I mean, some places like Boston, it was longer than that, but not much longer. So as a consequence, well, you were talking to me about Linux, a kind of open source learning where everyone was a potential teacher, and you know, any area of interest potentially could connect you with a whole lot of the learnings that would help you navigate the society. Because of that, I believe that the curriculum, the formal curriculum written down in the book, was easily superseded by a kind of practical curriculum, and I'll be specific about this, whatever seemed to be taught. Here are some of the things that were at the center of the curriculum, and I'm even going to sidestep the trivium and quadrivium, which are excellent ways to organize. But I'm going to sidestep those and say that probably the single distinguishing characteristic of an excellent mind, a trained mind, is the ability to concentrate and shut out everything else. In fact, there probably are no theories of intelligence that don't move concentration to the number one position as the most reliable evidence that you're dealing with a strong mind. Well, think of the schooling that exists now. The bells ring, or the horns of the buzzers, every 42 minutes. But in the meantime, it takes 10 minutes for all the kids to string into class because there are no penalties, nor do they understand what they're costing themselves. There are infinite numbers of loudspeaker announcements, messengers pounding on the door. I mean, our schools are a chaos of broken time. Now I'll step back a little bit farther and say, if somebody wanted to be certain that concentration didn't develop across a wide front in students, they would invent the kind of schooling that we have. Okay. The next thing I think that no one would disagree about is that the skills of associating with all kinds of people to move into a leadership association or a follower association or to an egalitarian association, those skills are priceless. Priceless. They don't tend to develop in an environment where you're not supposed to talk, you know, and you're not supposed to talk to anyone except the authority in front of the class. I could really beat this to death, but if you just wanted to create a skillful association and someone skilled at concentration, you would not go about it the way we're doing it. Now let me move into a third area, which most people would put first, probably, I would guess. The ability to express yourself verbally and behaviorally in all kinds of situations is just a sine qua non of opportunity. There's so many ways you can step on someone's toes or make yourself seem unacceptable to a group that if we only taught expression and left everything else up to the kids, we would be doing them a grand favor. So now we have concentration, association, expression, none of which are priorities, even in the gifted and talented programs. Then let me add what the early Americans may well have put at the top, and that was raw experience. You only need to read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography to see that by the age of 11, he probably had, certainly by the age of 13, he had more experience than the average person who grows up and drops dead in New York City. And he was hungry, and so were all of the people he associated with. He was hungry to get raw experience, even though he came from a family. They weren't poor, but they had no money. There were 17 kids. He crossed the Atlantic twice all by himself. I mean, we're talking about the 18th century, where it was, as they say, a trip. He put himself through a curriculum, and so did his friends. After working 60 hours a week, the Yale or Harvard would not dream of asking their undergraduates to match. So we have been stupendously dumbed down. Now I've touched four bases: concentration, association, expression, experience. We could go a little bit farther, but I think that's enough for a first chapter of reforming, when I say your own practice, I mean anyone listening who has kids, whether they're in school or whether they're being homeschooled.
What is the purpose of modern education?
Well, if you put yourself through a short course in the great philosophers of Western history, it's probably true the great philosophers of Eastern history too, but I'm much more knowledgeable about our part of the world, you would find that from Plato onwards, without exception, nobody believed that what you and I call education could possibly be true for most of the population, because they were hopelessly trapped in however they were born. You could condition habits, and you could condition attitudes. So you might get the simulation of a learned person, but it's we're all familiar. Plato divides people into gold, silver, bronze, and lead, I believe, although it's about 40 years since I've read it. You don't transmute those metals. You're stuck with them, and the base metals are a threat to the precious metals. Now move up quite a way through history to the so-called, move up to John Calvin, who was a magnificently learned attorney before he became the king Protestant theologian. And read Institutes of the Christian Religion, which will certainly give anyone who reads it a headache, but not because Calvin wastes words. He has a trained lawyer's mind. He says that salvation is already decided before you're born. About one person out of every 20 has been selected for salvation. The people so selected cannot commit an act so heinous, mass murder, forget it. They were called justified sinners. They were going to heaven regardless of what they did. But everybody else, let's say 95% of the population, was doomed whatever they did. So forget the old Catholic idea of good works and you earn your way to heaven. There was no way to get there. Now, what Calvin proposed, since 19-1 odds are pretty heavy odds to deal with if you happen to be saved, he constructs brilliantly a system of mass forced education. Forced is the important word, in which the denizens of the schools are so confused by half-truths and mal-teaching that they're never going to be a serious problem to the saved again. Let's jump a few hundred years forward in history to the so-called liberal philosopher Spinoza in Holland, taught everywhere as this grand liberal and champion of freedom. There's the truth there, but it's only true for one person out of 20. What Spinoza wrote, and I'll give you the actual reference because I have a feeling you'll have some scholarly listeners, readers. What Spinoza said was that the vast majority of the human race is murderously irrational. There's no cure for it, just as there's no cure for being born made of lead, or no cure being born already doomed, and Calvin said, there's no cure for this irrationality. And so to protect the good stuff, what has to be done is a system of universal forced schooling set up, which deliberately pumps the mind full of half-truths and outright errors, deprives the people of skill by teaching subjects rather than skills. I mean, concentration, association, expression are skills, but now we could turn that into English. What does that mean? You know, language arts. What does it mean? What does social studies mean? Well, it doesn't mean anything. It means whatever the particular instructor wants it to mean. So anyway, the big time philosopher, though, who's after Spinoza, is the guy who inherits Immanuel Kant's chair at the University of Berlin. It's a fellow named Johann Fichte, spelled F-I-C-H-T-E. And after Napoleon, with his amateur army, wipes out the Prussian army at the Battle of Jena in 1806, which takes place right under Immanuel Kant's window, you know, right around the precincts of the University of Berlin, Fichte makes public demands on the King of Prussia. He says, we got wiped out this way, and after all, our economy's based on warfare, so it's not a good advertising. He said, we lost because sergeants thought for themselves and lieutenants thought for themselves. He demanded that the King of Prussia institute a system of forced schooling, which would begin in early childhood and last until any scrap of independent critical thinking is wiped out. And according to Fichte, and of course Spinoza said exactly the same thing, the imagination is the great enemy of the best people. Because if this mass that's hopeless has an imagination left alive, it can surprise their betters. So he said, you got to wipe out the imagination. Well, now that sounds like a pretty big bill of goods, but it's not a big bill of goods if you put somebody in a rigorous, time-constrained environment. You deprive them of any other source of wisdom except the official state teaching. You can do quite a number on the imagination. And furthermore, if you tell them what they're supposed to imagine, so the popular expression is, if you don't teach them to connect the dots for themselves, but simply to memorize what they're told to memorize. And if they're going to have chains of analyses, those are to be memorized too. It doesn't really take very long before the mind can't do this for itself. In the current issue of The Atlantic, it used to be called The Atlantic Monthly, there's an article about what the effect of prolonged joblessness is going to be on this country. And the Atlantic writer predicts joblessness will last as far into the future as we can see, that there'll be temporary recoveries, but there'll be illusions. In the course of doing that, and this is the current issue of Atlantic, March 10th, I believe is the cover date, the fellow says that the highly structured school childhoods that the young adults have come out of right now have temperamentally unprepared them for the circumstances of the moment, that the graduates dislike the idea of work, and about one-third of them don't even try to engage the jobs market. And these are qualities directly quoted from that article. When he's profiling what these new young men and women are like, he says they blame others for their own difficulties. They expect someone else to fix any problems they encounter. They lack independence, entrepreneurialism, leadership skills, problem-solving ability, and they need almost constant direction. We're not talking about the dunces. We're talking about the best who come out of these programs. They flounder without precise guidelines. That's what forced schooling teaches. You wait for someone else to tell you what to do. And yet in the world you and I have been plunged in, what it demands is adaptability, perseverance, enterprise, and humility, not self-esteem. Our recent graduates expect rewards without exchanging successful performance for them. What we desperately need is children willing to give value back to the community, young people rooted in the work that a coherent society needs them to do. And if you say, well, what work is that? I urge your listeners to pick up the 100-page-long autobiography of Benjamin Franklin and prepare, if you haven't read it before, to have your hair stand up straight on your head. We've created a mass of parasitic young people who essentially can't do anything. And more than that, they don't want to do anything. They want to be cared for. We have a leadership that collapses the economy and pays themselves $100 million bonuses a year. I mean, we're in a much deeper mess, I think, than even the newspapers acknowledge. It's not temporary at all.
I think the newspapers are actually behind in helping to promote this whole system. You know, they certainly aren't doing investigative quality journalism anymore. You have to go to the internet and places like that to get good independent journalism these days.
Yes, I would agree with you. Of course, the newspapers and the magazines are owned by the people who own the economy, but I'll pass that by.
All right. Do genetics and eugenics play into the organizational structure of the modern school system?
Hugely. The biggest culprit, I named Spinoza and Calvin and Fichte and Plato. By far, the biggest culprit is Charles Darwin. By far, the innocent man of wealth who travels on the Beagle and publishes a book in 1859 called Origin of Species. And I want your listeners to listen hard enough to hear, I'm not talking about the theory of evolution. I'm talking about Darwin's conclusion 12 years after he wrote Origin of Species. The book is The Descent of Man. It will be in every library in the United States. That's how carefully it's put out there, you know, so that the Inner Circle Club can renew their faith in what they're doing. What he says in Descent of Man is that the overwhelming mass of the human race, including all the Irish, I'm sorry, I'm a little bit Irish, but the audiences who want to be skeptical, I urge them to go to Descent of Man and read what Darwin says about the Irish. If these lower forms of life, which are about 95% of the people on Earth, including, as I said, all the Irish, if they crossbreed with the good stuff, Darwin said evolution would march backwards into the swirling mists of the dawnless past. In other words, if you're a responsible person of means, then what you have to do is join in a kind of gentleman's agreement to separate the good breeding stock from the bad breeding stock, which is, after all, 95% of the population, and then turn that 95% against one another. Because just as Calvin discovered, you know, 19 to 1 odds are bad odds. There aren't enough of the good people to keep the bad people down. They have to be trained to keep themselves down. And far and away, the best way to do that is what Julius Caesar discovered when he was conquering Gaul. You set your enemies against themselves in large ways and small ways. You underwrite and maintain infinite numbers of competitions so they come to see one another as their enemies, as someone blocking their path to opportunity. I mean, we start this in first grade. If some of your listeners say, is he going to attack competition? No, in a moment I'm going to argue that one form of competition is utterly essential to a good life. But first let me take the pop quizzes and prelims and standardized tests and final exam, midterm exams. What we're dealing with here is a way to keep the ordinary population from bonding together in common interest. You'll recall that in the standard biography of Horace Mann by Messerly is the writer's name. Messerly notes that there's a curious entry in Horace Mann's diary that he made while he was watching a parade of working men in Boston in 1843. Mann jots down this thought: we must find a way to break the bond of association among working men. What could that possibly mean? Why must we find a way to do that?
Why indeed? A tricky one for advocates of compulsory schooling to answer, I feel. And on that quizzical note, we're going to stop the interview for this week. We'll hear a bit more of it next week. And now we're going to shift back 4 decades to material that was thought out before John Taylor Gatto had thought about borrowing his roommate's teaching license and starting a career in teaching. And this doesn't have the historical insights about the origins of forced schooling, but it has a lot more, and although it includes the word school in the title, Ivan Illich is certainly not limiting his attention to schools. So I find that his insights potentially very helpful in the designing of new software with which to break the control of centralized systems over the public imagination. De-schooling Society, Chapter 1. Why we must disestablish school. Many students, especially those who are poor, intuitively know what the schools do for them. They school them to confuse process and substance. Once these become blurred, a new logic is assumed. The more treatment there is, the better are the results, or escalation leads to success. The pupil is thereby schooled to confuse teaching with learning, grade advancement with education, a diploma with competence, and fluency with the ability to say something new. His imagination is schooled to accept service in place of value. Medical treatment is mistaken for health care, social work for the improvement of community life, police protection for safety, military poise for national security, the rat race for productive work, health, learning, dignity, independence, and creative endeavor are defined as little more than the performance of those institutions which claim to serve these ends, and their improvement is made to depend on allocating more resources to the management of hospitals, schools, and other agencies in question. In these essays, I will show that the institutionalization of values leads inevitably to physical pollution, social polarization, and psychological impotence, three dimensions in a process of global degradation and modernized misery. I will examine how this process of degradation is accelerated when non-material needs are transformed into demands for commodities, when health, education, personal mobility, welfare, or psychological healing are defined as the results of services or treatments. I do this because I believe that most of the research now going on about the future tends to advocate further increases in the institutionalization of values, and that we must define conditions which would permit precisely the contrary to happen. We need research on the possible use of technology to create institutions which serve personal, creative, and autonomous interaction, and the emergence of values which cannot be substantially controlled by technocrats. We need counterfoil research to current futurology. I want to raise the general question of the mutual definition of man's nature and the nature of modern institutions, which characterizes our worldview and language. To do so, I have chosen the school as my paradigm. I therefore deal only indirectly with other bureaucratic agencies of the corporate state, the consumer family, the party, the army, the church, the media. My analysis of the hidden curriculum of school should make it evident that public education would profit from the deschooling of society, just as family life, politics, security, faith, and communication would profit from an analogous process. I begin my analysis in this first essay by trying to convey what the deschooling of a schooled society might mean. In this context, it should be easier to understand my choice of the five specific aspects relevant to this process with which I deal in the subsequent chapters. Not only education, but social reality itself has become schooled. It costs roughly the same to school both rich and poor in the same dependency. The yearly expenditure per pupil in the slums and in the rich suburbs of any one of 20 US cities lies in the same range and is sometimes favorable to the poor. Rich and poor alike depend on schools and hospitals which guide their lives, form their world view, and define for them what is legitimate and what is not. Both view doctoring oneself as irresponsible, learning on one's own as unreliable, and community organization, when not paid for by those in authority, as a form of aggression or subversion. For both groups, the reliance on institutional treatment renders independent accomplishment suspect.